వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సమప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం నచేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Shri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning. Greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday on the 12th of March 2020, and with me Team Radio Sai Sunil welcoming you to this morning segment Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashantinilayam. Let me as always first read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What is the real characteristic of true devotion? Bhagwan endearingly guides us today, and I quote, "Devotion is not wearing an ochre cloth or organizing festivals or performing ritual sacrifices or shaving the hair or carrying water pot or rod or matting the hair, etc. The Lord will never judge you at any time on the basis of the religion or caste you belong to or the precepts you traditionally follow. The real characteristic of true devotion are 1. Having a pure mind or antakarana. 2. Uninterrupted contemplation on God, whatever be your profession in daily living. 3. The feeling that everything is Lord's creation and therefore one. 4. Acceptance of all with equal love. 5. Non-attachment to sense objects. And 6. Practicing true speech. Whoever you are, in whatever condition you may be, if you do not give room for dispiritedness, if you have no fear at all, and if you remember the Lord with unshaken faith and without any ulterior motive, all your suffering and sorrow will surely fall away." Unquote. This was taken from Prema Vahini, chapter 61. Dear listener, the time right now in our studios is 48 minutes past 9 a.m. that is Indian Standard Time, and today in Divine Glory I have lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by the third part of a conversation with Dr. Alan Levy, a practicing psychoanalyst from the United States of America. First, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitran is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemad Pant. We're thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. And here it is for your listening pleasure.
Baba's yogic practices. Baba knew all the processes and practices of yoga. Two of them will be described here. Dhauti Kriya or cleansing process. Baba went to the well near the banyan tree at a considerable distance from the masjid every third day, washed his mouth and had a bath. On one occasion, he was seen throwing up his intestines, cleaned them inside out and placed them on a jam tree for drying. There are persons in Shirdi who have actually seen this and have testified to this fact. Ordinary dhauti is done by a moistened piece of linen, 3 inches broad and 22.5 feet long. This piece is gulped down the throat and allowed to remain in the stomach for about half an hour for being reacted there and then taken out. But Baba's dhauti was quite unique and extraordinary. The other yogic practice was Khanda Yoga. In this practice, Baba extracted the limbs from his body and left them separately at different places in the masjid. Once a gentleman went to the masjid and saw the limbs of Baba lying at separate places. He was much terrified. He first thought of running to the village officers and informing them of Baba being hacked to pieces and murdered. He thought he would be held responsible as he was the first informant and knew something of the affair. So he kept silent. But next day, when he went to the masjid, he was very much surprised to see Baba hale and hearty as before. He thought what he had seen the previous day was only a dream. Baba practiced yoga since his infancy and nobody knew or guessed the proficiency he attained. He charged no fees for his cures and became renowned and famous by virtue of his merits, gave health to many a poor and suffering person. This famous doctor of doctors cared not for his interests, but always worked for the good and welfare of the others, himself suffering unbearable and terrible pain many a time in the process. One such instance I give below, which will show the all-pervasive and most merciful character of Sai Baba. Baba's all-pervasiveness and mercy. In the year 1910, Baba was sitting near the dhuni on Diwali and warming himself. He was pushing firewood into the dhuni, which was brightly burning. A little later, instead of pushing logs of wood, Baba pushed his arm into the dhuni. The arm was scorched and burned. This was noticed by the errand boy Madhav and also by Madhav Rao Deshpande. They at once ran to Baba and Madhav Rao clasped Baba by his waist from behind and dragged him forcibly backward and asked, "Deva, for what have you done this?" Then Baba came to his senses and replied, "The wife of a blacksmith at some distant place was working the bellows of a furnace. Her husband called her. Forgetting that a child was in her lap, she got up hastily and the child slipped into the furnace. I immediately thrust my hand into the furnace and saved the child. I do not mind my arm being burnt, but I'm glad the life of the child is saved." Leper devotee's service. On hearing the news of Baba's hand being burnt from Shama, Mr. Nana Saheb Chandorkar, accompanied by the famous Dr. Paramanand of Mumbai, with his medical outfit consisting of ointments, lints and bandages, rushed to Shirdi and requested Baba to allow Dr. Paramanand to examine the arm and dress the wound caused by the burn. This was refused. Ever since the burnt arm was dressed by the leper devotee Bhagoji Shinde, his treatment consisted in massaging the burnt part with ghee and then placing a leaf over it and bandaging it tightly. Mr. Nana Saheb Chandorkar solicited Baba many a time to unfasten the bandages, get the wound examined, dressed and treated by Dr. Paramanand, with the object that it may heal fast. Dr. Paramanand himself made similar requests, but Baba postponed, saying Allah was his doctor and did not allow his arm to be examined. Dr. Paramanand's medicines were not exposed to the air of Shirdi and they remained intact. But he had the good fortune of getting a darshan of Baba. Bhagoji was allowed to treat the hand daily. After some days, the arm healed and all were happy. Still, We do not know whether any trace of pain was left or not. Every morning, Bhagoji went through the program of untying the bandages, massaging the arm with ghee, and tightly bandaging it again. This went on till Sai Baba's samadhi. Sai Baba, a perfect siddha as he was, did not really want this treatment. But out of love for his devotee, he allowed the upasana, service of Bhagoji, to go on uninterrupted all along. When Baba started for Lendi, Bhagoji held an umbrella over him and accompanied him every morning. When Baba sat near the post close to the dhuni, Bhagoji was present and started his service. Bhagoji was a sinner in his past birth. He was suffering from leprosy. His fingers had shrunk, his body was full of pus and smelling badly. Though outwardly he seemed so unfortunate, he was really very lucky and happy, for he was the premier servant of Baba and got the benefit of his company. Master Karpade's plague case. I shall now relate another incident of Baba's wonderful leela. Mrs. Karpade, the wife of Mr. Dada Sahib Karpade of Amravati, was sitting at Shirdi with her son for some days. One day, the son got high fever, which further developed into bubonic plague. The mother was very frightened and felt most uneasy. She thought of leaving the place for Amravati and went near Baba in the evening when he was coming near the Vada in his evening rounds for asking his permission. She informed him in a trembling tone that her dear young son was down with plague. Baba spoke kindly and softly to her, saying that the sky is beset with clouds, but they will melt and pass off and everything will be smooth and clear. So saying, he lifted up his kafni up to the waist and showed to all present four fully developed buboes as big as eggs and added, "See how I have to suffer for my devotees? Their difficulties are mine." Seeing this unique and extraordinary deed, the people were convinced as to how the saints suffer pains for their devotees. The mind of the saints is softer than wax. It is soft in and out as butter. They love the devotees without any idea of gain and regard them as their true relatives. Going to Pandharpur. I shall now close this chapter after relating a story illustrating how Sai Baba loved his devotees and anticipated their wishes and movements. Mr. Nana Sahib Chandurkar, who was a great devotee of Baba, was Mamlatdar at Nandarbar in Khandesh. His devotion to Sai Baba bore fruit as he got an order to go and stay at Pandharpur, which is regarded as the Bhu Vaikuntha, heaven on the earth. Nana Sahib had to take immediate charge, so he left for the place without even writing or informing anybody at Shirdi. He wanted to give a surprise visit to Shirdi, his Pandharpur, see and salute his Vitoba, Baba, and then proceed further. Nobody knew of Nana Sahib's departure for Shirdi, but Sai Baba knew all of this. His eyes were everywhere. As soon as Nana Sahib approached Nimgaon, a few miles from Shirdi, there was a stir in the masjid at Shirdi. Baba was sitting and talking with Mahal Sapati, Appa Shinde and Kashiram, when he at once said, "Let us all four do some bhajan. The doors of Pandari are open. Let us merrily sing." Then they began to sing in chorus, the bhava of the song being, "I have to go to Pandharpur and I have to stay on there, for it is the house of my Lord." Baba sang and the devotees followed him. After a short while, Nana Sahib came there and his family prostrated before Baba and requested him to accompany them to Pandharpur and stay with them there. This solicitation was not necessary, as the devotees told Nana Sahib that Baba was already in the mood of going to Pandharpur and staying there. Hearing this, Nana Sahib was moved and fell at Baba's feet. Then after getting Baba's permission and Udi and his blessings, Nana Sahib left for Pandharpur. There is no end to Baba's stories, but let me now make a halt, reserving for the next chapter other topics such as importance of human life, Baba's living on alms, Bhaija Bhai's service and other stories. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 8. Importance of human birth, Sai Baba begging food, Bhaija Bhai's service, Sai Baba's dormitory, his affection for Kushal Chand. As hinted in the last chapter, Hemad Pant now explains at length in his preliminary remarks the importance of human birth and then proceeds to relate how Sai Baba begged his food, how Bhaija Bhai served him, how he slept in the masjid with Tatya Kote Patil and Mahal Sapati, and how he loved Kushal Chand of Rahata. Importance of human birth. In this wonderful universe, God has created billions of creatures or beings, including gods, demigods, insects, beasts and men, inhabiting heaven, hell, earth, ocean, sky and other intermediate regions. Of these, those creatures or souls whose merits preponderate go to heaven and live there till they enjoy the fruits of their actions, and when this is done, they are cast down. While those souls whose sins or demerits preponderate go down to hell and suffer the consequences of their misdeeds for as long as they deserve it. When their merits and demerits balance each other, they are born on earth as human beings and are given a chance to work out their salvation. Ultimately, when their merits and demerits both are worked out completely, they get their deliverance and become free. To put the matter in a nutshell, souls get their birth or transmigration according to their deeds and involvement. Special value of the human body. As we all know, four things are common to all the creatures: food, sleep, fear and sexual union. In the case of man, he is endowed with a special faculty, knowledge, with the help of which he can attain God vision, which is impossible in any other birth. It is for this reason that gods envy human species and aspire to be born as men on the earth so as to get their final deliverance. Some people say there is nothing worse than the human body, which is full of filth, mucus, phlegm and dirt, and which is subject to decay, disease and death. This is true to a certain extent, but in spite of these drawbacks and defects, the special value of the human body is that man has got the capacity to acquire knowledge. It is only due to the human body or on account of it that one can think of the perishable and transitory nature of the body itself and of the world, and have an aversion for the sense enjoyments, and can discriminate between the unreal and the real, and thus attain God vision. So, if we reject or neglect the body because it is filthy, we lose the chance of God's vision, and if we fondle it and run after sense enjoyments because it is precious, we go to hell. The proper course therefore for us is to pursue that the body should neither be neglected nor fondled, but should be properly cared for, just as a traveller on horseback takes care of his pony on the way till he reaches his destination and returns home. Thus, the body should ever be used or engaged to attain God vision or self-realization, which is the supreme end of life. It is said that though God created various sorts of creatures, he was not satisfied, for none of them was able to know and appreciate his work. So, he had to create a special being, man, and endow him with a special faculty, knowledge. And when he saw that man was able to appreciate his leela, marvelous work and intelligence, he was highly pleased and satisfied. So really, it is fortunate to get a human body, better still to get birth in a Brahmin family, and best to get an opportunity of having recourse to Sai Baba's feet and surrendering to him. Man's endeavor. Realizing how precious a human life is, and knowing that death is certain and may snatch us at any time, we should be ever alert to achieve the object of our life. We should not make the least delay, but make every possible haste to gain our object, just as a king leaves no stone unturned to seek his lost son. So with all earnestness, we should strive to attain our end, self-realization. Casting aside laziness, warding off drowsiness, we should, day and night, meditate on the self. If we fail to do this, we reduce ourselves to the level of beasts. How to proceed? The most effective and speedy way to gain our object is to approach a worthy saint or sage, Sadguru, who has himself attained God vision. What cannot be achieved by hearing religious discourses and study of religious texts is easily obtained in the company of such worthy souls. Just as the sun only gives light, which all the stars put together cannot do, so the Sadguru alone imparts spiritual wisdom, which all the sacred books and sermons cannot do. His movements and simple talks give us silent advice. The virtues of forgiveness, calmness, disinterestedness, charity, benevolence, control of mind and body, egolessness are observed by the disciples as they are being practiced in such pure and holy company. This enlightens their minds and lifts them spiritually. Sai Baba was such a sage or Sadguru. Though he acted the fakir, he was always engrossed in the self. He always loved all beings in whom he saw God or divinity. By pleasures, he was not elated. He was not depressed by misfortunes. A king and a pauper were the same to him. He, whose glance would turn a beggar into a king, used to beg his food from door to door in Shirdi. And let us now see how he did that. Baba begging food. Blessed are the people of Shirdi in front of whose houses Baba stood as a beggar and called out, "Oh my, give me a piece of bread," and spread out his hand to receive the same. In one hand he carried a tin pot and the other a jholi, a rectangular piece of cloth. He daily visited certain houses and went from door to door. Liquid or semi-liquid things such as soup, vegetables, milk or buttermilk were received in the tin pot, while cooked rice, bread and solid things were taken in the jholi. Baba's tongue knew no taste as he had acquired control over it. So how could he care for the taste of the different things mixed up together? Whatever things he got in his jholi and in the tin pot were mixed together and partaken by Baba to his heart's content. Whether particular things were tasty or otherwise was never noticed by Baba, as his tongue was devoid of the sense of taste altogether. Baba begged till noon, but his begging was very regular. Some days he went a few rounds and other days up to 12 in the afternoon. The food thus collected was kept in a kundi, earthen pot. Dogs, cats, crows freely ate from it and Baba never drove them away. The woman who swept the floor of the masjid took some 10 to 12 pieces of bread to her house and nobody prevented her from doing so. How could he, who even in dreams never warded off cats and dogs by harsh words and signs, refuse food to poor, helpless people? Blessed indeed is the life of such a noble person. People in Shirdi took him in the beginning for a mad fakir. He was known in the village by this name. How could one who lived on alms by begging a few crumbs of bread be revered and worshipped? But this fakir was very liberal at heart, detached and charitable. Though he looked restless from outside, he was firm and steady inside. His way was inscrutable. Still in that small village, there were a few kind and blessed people who recognized and regarded him as a great soul. One such instance is given below. Baijabai's brilliant service. Tatya Kote's mother, Baijabai, used to go to the woods every noon with a basket on her head containing bread and vegetables. She roamed in the jungles about 3 miles, trampling bushes and shrubs in search of the mad fakir, and after finding him out, fell at his feet. The fakir sat calm and motionless in meditation while she placed a leaf before him, spread her things, bread, vegetables, and fed him insistently. Wonderful was her faith and service. Every day she roamed at noon in the jungles and insisted Baba to partake of the lunch. Her service, upasana, by whatever name we call it, was never forgotten by Baba till the end. Remembering fully what service she rendered, Baba benefited her son significantly. Both the son and the mother had great faith in the fakir who was their god. Baba once said to them, "Fakiri is real, lordship is transient." After some years, Baba left going into the woods and began to live in the village and take his food in the masjid. Hence, Baijabai's troubles of roaming in the jungles ended. Dormitory of Trio. Ever blessed are the saints in whose heart Lord Vasudeva dwells, and fortunate indeed are the devotees who get the benefit of the company of such saints. Two such fortunate fellows, Tatya Kote Patil and Bhagat Mahasapati, equally share the company of Sai Baba. Baba loved them both. These three persons slept in the masjid with their heads towards the east, west and north, and with their feet touching one another at the center. After spreading their beds, they lay on them chit-chatting and gossiping till late at night. If any one of them showed any signs of sleep, others would wake him up. For instance, if Tatya began to snore, Baba at once got up and shook him from side to side and pressed his head. If it was Mahasapati, he pulled him close, stroked his legs and patted his back. In this way, for a period of 14 years, Tatya, leaving his parents at home, slept in the masjid on account of his deep love for Baba. How happy and never to be forgotten were those days. How to measure that love and how to value the grace of Baba. After the passing away of his father, Tatya took charge of the household affairs and began to sleep at home. Kushal Chand of Rahata. Baba loved Ganpat Kote Patil of Shirdi. He equally loved Chandrabhan Seth Marwadi of Rahata. After the demise of this sage, Baba loved his nephew Kushal Chand equally or perhaps more and looked after his welfare day and night. Sometimes in a bullock cart, at other times in a tonga with intimate devotees, Baba went to Rahata. People of that village would come out with band and music and receive Baba at the gate of the village and prostrate before him. Then he was taken into the village with great ceremony. Kushal Chand took Baba to his house, seated him on a comfortable seat and gave him a good meal. Then they talked freely and merrily for some time, after which Baba returned to Shirdi, giving delight and blessings to all. Shirdi is midway and equidistant from Rahat on one side and Nimgaon on the other. Baba never went beyond these places during his lifetime. He never saw any train nor travelled by it. Still, he knew exactly the timings of arrival and departure of all the trains. Devotees who acted according to Baba's instructions given at the time of taking his leave fared well, while those who disregarded them suffered many a mishap and accident. More about this and other matters will be told in the next chapter. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 9. Effect of compliance and non-compliance with Baba's orders at the time of taking leave. A few instances. Mendicancy and his necessity. Devotees. Tarkhat's family. Experiences. Baba fed sumptuously. At the end of the last chapter, it was briefly stated that the bhaktas who obeyed Baba's orders at the time of taking leave fared well, and those who disobeyed them suffered many a mishap. This statement will be amplified and illustrated with a few striking instances and by other matters dealt with in this chapter. Characteristic of Shirdi pilgrimage. One special peculiarity of Shirdi pilgrimage was that none could leave Shirdi without Baba's permission, and if he did, he invited trouble. But if anyone was asked to quit Shirdi, he could stay there no longer. Baba gave certain suggestions or hints when devotees went to bid goodbye and take his leave. These suggestions had to be followed. If they were not followed or were departed from, accidents were sure to befall them. We give below a few instances. Tatya Kote Patil. Tatya Kote was once going in a tonga to Kopargaon Bazaar. He came in haste to the masjid, saluted Baba and said he would go to Kopargaon Bazaar. Baba said, "Don't make haste. Stop a little. Forget the bazaar. Don't go out of the village." On seeing his anxiousness to go, Baba asked him to take Shama with him. Not minding this direction, Tatya Kote immediately drove off his tonga. Of the two horses, one which was costing about 300 rupees was very active and restless. After passing Sawli Vihir, it began to run rashly, got a sprain in its waist and fell down. Tatya was not much hurt, but was reminded of Mother Sai's direction. On another occasion, while proceeding to Kolhar village, he disregarded Baba's direction and drove in a tonga which met with a similar accident. European gentleman. One European gentleman of Mumbai once came to Shirdi with an introductory note from Nana Sahib Chandorkar and with some object in view. He was comfortably accommodated in a tent. He wanted to kneel before Baba and kiss his hand. Therefore, he tried thrice to step into the masjid, but Baba prevented him from doing so. He was asked to sit in the open courtyard below and take Baba's darshan from there. Not pleased with the reception he got, he wanted to leave Shirdi at once and came to bid goodbye. Baba asked him to go the next day and not to make hurry. People also requested him to abide by Baba's direction. Not listening to all this, he left Shirdi in a tonga. The horses ran all right, but when Sawli Vihir was passed, a bicycle came in front, on seeing which the horses were frightened and ran fast. The tonga was turned topsy-turvy and the gentleman fell down and was dragged over some distance. He was immediately rescued, but had to go and lie in Kopargaon Hospital for the treatment of his injuries. Such experiences were legion, and all the people learned the lesson that those who disobeyed Baba's instruction met with accidents in one way or the other, and those who obeyed them were safe and happy.
to Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Dear listeners, Sai Ram. In our series of conversations, we now bring you a conversation with Dr. Alan Levy, a practicing modern psychoanalyst from Westport, Connecticut, USA. Dr. Levy was in private practice in Manhattan for 20 years before moving to Connecticut in the year 2000. He is also a senior faculty member of the Center for Group Studies in Manhattan and past faculty member at the Union Graduate School, Cincinnati, Ohio. He has been in this profession, serving people with mental and psychological ailments for over 3 decades now. In this conversation with Radio Sai's Bishop Rushdie, Alan discusses about the universal aspect of Swami's teachings and how to apply them in our lives so as to broaden our hearts with love. This conversation was recorded in the studios of Radio Sai in the month of November 2011. So, over now to the conversation with Dr. Alan Levy.
Sai Ram, Dr. Alan Levy, and welcome again to the studios of Radio Sai. You have come here before and we have had earlier 2 conversations with you. I think that was in the month of May or June after Swami's passing. And that was a very beautiful conversation where we talked about how to see Swami in all, the experience that you have had and how your life has transformed from being an atheist to now becoming a psychiatrist to becoming a psychiatrist. And then the other conversation was on meditation, how Swami guided you about how to do meditation. I think those 2 are very insightful conversations we have had. And today we have you again to know your perspective of Swami's message.
Thank you very, very much, Bijan. It's so wonderful to be here once again, and I appreciate the invitation to speak on behalf of my own experience in relationship to everyone else who is a devotee and those who want to be or those who don't even know about Swami.
That's great. So this is my first question.
Okay.
Now, you were born Jewish, and you grew up in that environment.
Yes.
And in the 70s, you came to Swami, you visited Prashanthi Nilayam, and you were drawn to his message, his love. Now, coming from such a background, was it really difficult or easy for you to accept Swami?
Oh, the first time I heard of Swami, it was extremely difficult to understand that a being, a human being, I thought, could be, first of all, enlightened, and then, secondly, God, or first God, then enlightened. I had no comprehension of this. It wasn't in my mental vocabulary. I was a very mental person, thinking and logical, and it was incomprehensible to me how anyone could be anything but a human being who just had ways of expressing themselves just like all other human beings. But when I read about Swami, and this was the book Baba by Arnold Schumann, not a very scholarly work about Swami. I mean, it was like a human perspective of who Swami is. But within 10 pages, I closed the book and I said, oh my God, God is real and this is God. It just happened like that.
And so you had no problems about your background?
That's not quite the case. Once I heard all the Sanskrit and all the bhajans and the Eastern ways of devotion and spirituality, it was not part of my life at that time, and I had to make an adjustment. I had to grow into understanding. Fortunately, at the same time that I heard about Swami from my brother, who had heard about Swami from Hilda Charlton, the first Western devotee ever to come here in about 1965.
One of those very early Western devotees.
Yes, in Ranima, sister Lily, was Hilda Charlton's roommate back in 64, 65, I guess. And they lived inside Swami's house in Vrindavan. Swami had invited them there. And so Hilda had intimate stories to tell of Swami's love. This is what brought me really into understanding that the Eastern ways of being with Swami through bhajan, through prayer, through Vedas, was just a structure, but a case in which this essence of love was kept, or given expression, let's put it that way. It had to be given an expression in some way, and this was a beautiful way to give that expression. Hilda, who I met shortly after I found out in my side myself that Baba was real and God, I met Hilda right away, and then she helped me understand. So she helped me make that transition. And that transition took at least 4 years. Took about 4 years to really get it.
So what is it that you unlearned and learned?
I unlearned my prejudices, my opinions. I unlearned a lot of my body identifications. That I was Jewish born, that as a result of that I had certain likes and dislikes. Maybe I even had some tastes that I preferred this way, not that way. These things Hilda showed me through her love for Swami and her awareness of the universality of that love. I learned that I too had to expand into a universality of love if I wanted to progress spiritually. And that expansion had to be inclusive, not exclusive. So if I was in a meeting where people were singing love for God, like, here, the saints go marching in, or glory to God, or some English bhajans, I did that. If they expressed it in Hebrew prayers, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu, I went with that. If somebody was singing the Ave Maria and how wonderful the glory of Mary was, the mother of Jesus, I went with that. This is what I learned. And then when I went to bhajans in a Sai Center, and we sang bhajans, I went with that. I felt the love in whatever form it took. I didn't have a
preference.
So you
expanded your consciousness.
Absolutely. And that's part of the spiritual journey. That's part of the spiritual sadhana. And this type of inclusiveness and universality, not narrow-mindedness, that helped me go from a petty little ego self to a more expanded version of ego self.
Wonderful. As you mentioned this, I'm reminded of what Swami said, or rather it was a divine message that Swami gave for the first International Sai Conference, which was held in Rome in October 1983. Swami says, "To confine and divide the infinite divine into such narrow compartments is treason to the divine. The basis for a spiritual God-based life is the indwelling spirit, the Atma, and the body is the home of the spirit." And as you mentioned this, what I'm thinking is, one can go into this consciousness of spirit only when you break those narrow barriers.
This
and I think
true.
That is the process of unlearning that happened with you, and that is probably what many Westerners will go through. And once that happens, then they are into a world of freedom. Then they are into a world where they can expand their consciousness and everything becomes beautiful.
That's right. That's really true. In actuality, Swami takes us from body consciousness to Atmic consciousness. That journey from body consciousness and body identification, I am, for instance, a man or a woman, I am a white person, I am a Hindu person, I am, an African-American person. These things are so superficial. Because this is the form that we incarnate into. All of us, to meet Swami and to know about Swami, all of us, if you have heard the words Satya Sai Baba, that means that everyone has incarnated into every style of body, every religion, every culture, every particular way of worshiping God, and now is about to graduate. And graduation from this planet, from birth and death, into eternal oneness, infinite spirit. As Swami has said, I was never born and I will never die. Into that awareness takes maybe a few incarnations more, not that many. But we have had to have lived in all styles of living on this planet and have done all things to come to this stage of our evolution of consciousness as a soul in God. And to just hear the words Bhagavan Sri Satya Sai Baba means that we have come to this point.
As you are saying, you know, this is a journey and this is going to take some while. But if you look at it on a very, very down-to-earth level, you know, when an initial devotee comes from the Western Hemisphere, you know, there are occasions when he can get repelled by the Veda chanting or the Bhajan chanting. Did you have a similar experience?
At first, certainly the Vedas weren't chanted when I began in 1971 with Swami, but the Bhajans, I used to sit there and go, I don't understand a word of this, and it sounds like gibberish to me. But I could feel inside the song, I could feel this energy of love being expressed. That was, I was aware of. But I could not express it in that particular way, that love. I couldn't sing Sanskrit or Telugu or Hindi bhajans. And so I had to get used to them, and it took many years. But when I first came to Prashanti in 78, because I was taking care of Hilda, and Swami had me do that, driving her around, and, you know, I lived in her apartment as a brahmacharya with seven others who were brahmacharyas. It was like a nunnery, in a sense, but I was a monk, kind of, thinking that way. And so to come to Swami, I had to bring Hilda and 25 students. So it took a while to get that organized and to get permission with Hilda to do it. And then we brought Hilda came with her 25 students and myself. And within 4 days, Swami called us in. And the first, you know, just started expressing love to all of us. And it just blew me away. And when I felt that love that Swami had, I knew that everything here had a purpose, a reason, and was true to form. That it was Swami's will that I be there, but also that I hear these bhajans and express love towards him in these particular ways. Now, along the way, 2 years later, Swami celebrated Hanukkah with myself and about 20 other Westerners and Jewish people, and he invited me to be the rabbi, to light the menorah candles, which is done. And there's 8 candles, and Swami lit the candles while I sung the prayers. And this festival is coming up. It's always at Christmas time, usually Hanukkah's first, and then Christmas a few days or weeks afterward. And those prayers that went something like this, Boruch ato Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher kirishonu b'mitzvosov v'tzivonu lehadnik ner shel chanucha. Now, maybe no one has ever heard this. Some of the people listening have never heard this prayer, and that might be the first time they've heard it. And then they think, oh, what's that? That's not for me. I don't express love to God like that. But if you feel what's inside those words, even though they're foreign sounds, you can feel God's love for us. And as we express those thoughts and prayers and sing those words, we express our love for God. And that unites us into a oneness. And you could feel the upliftment of the oneness within yourself.
So how it happened with you is, first you are mesmerized by Him, then you develop love for Him. And once that happened, that opened the doors to accept everything and understand them in the right perspective.
Yes. Now, that's very real. That's the very truth of it. But the fact is, the body is like a magnet. Actually, it's like a gravitational force. It constantly tries to pull the awareness back into the mundane, into the petty, into what separates us, not what unites us. We have to, through our effort, our sincere, intense effort, feel that I am really not the body. I am beyond the body. I am not even the mind. I am beyond my thoughts, beyond my feelings. I am not my mind. I am the witness of the mind, and I am the witness of the body and how it changes. And who am I really? And Swami has said, you are God. But what does that mean? We have to affirm, I am Sat-Chit-Ananda, truth, consciousness, bliss. Grief and anxiety can never affect me. I am ever content. Fear cannot enter me. Why? Because we are God. And as God, there is only infinite love. There is no fear, anxiety, separation, likes, dislikes, opinions, things like that. So we have to resist the gravitational pull of the body to pull us back into all this delusion of, I am a human being, I am a man, I am a woman, I am
young, old. I was born into this kind of environment, and this is the only thing that I should follow in life. I cannot accept the other thing is foreign.
There you go. There we go. Because we are one humanity, we are one world, we are one God in all forms. God is in all forms.
And the other thing that eventually we understand is that every person is born into a particular situation, into a particular environment. And it is the same even with God. When the Almighty comes down as an avatar, He is also born in a particular geographical area. And that area has its own ways of living, its language, its culture. And the avatar adapts to it. I mean, he accepts that. And that's how so many practices develop.
Absolutely.
Baba was born in Andhra, so he spoke Telugu.
Yes.
And people here would have the bhajans in these languages because that is what they are used to. I think if he was born in maybe an English-speaking country, then we would have had more English bhajans.
Absolutely.
So probably what is important to understand is to look at it from the right perspective and then go by the spirit and not look at it superficially.
That's right. Exactly. Beautiful. So when in, for instance, Germany, to sing bhajans, we sing in German. Mm. We sing in the language of our land. But when we come to India, because the avatar, God chose to be in a human form at this particular time in India. At another time, 2,000 years ago, He chose to be in the form of Jesus in Jerusalem.
Yes.
And at another time previous to that, another area. Mm. So wherever the need is best met, to that God comes to transform and transmute humanity, then that where God is going to be protected in that human form,
yes,
He will come. He is best protected at this time in India. That is why there are three incarnations of God in India, Shirdi Sai, Sati Sai, and Prema Sai. This 300-year period is the most transformational period in the history of the world. This is the step of evolution of consciousness that when we take the quantum leap as catalytically converted by the avatar being here at this time, all of the universe will be positively affected and thereby transformed as well. We are the contemporaries of the avatar in this age of the Kali Yuga. There is a purpose and a point to it, and everyone who hears the name of Satya Sai Baba has a part to play in that mission. Every single human being, you are hearing our voice now, you have a part to play. Do not turn away from that part just because the flavor isn't chocolate.
Mm.
It may be vanilla. It may be strawberry. You may not like vanilla and strawberry necessarily. But if that's the flavor offered, partake of it, because there is great nurturance in that. God has come at this time to nurture us all with love so we can realize our divinity, our humanity in divinity, the love that we can all share as a unity of faith, as a unity of culture, as a unity of the language of love. This is our divine purpose. This is why the avatar has come at this time.
And in the same way, if you look at Swami's stress on Indian culture, you know, we had even summer courses on Indian culture. Swami had it every year for the students. In many of his discourses, he stressed about the nuances of Indian culture. Again, for a Westerner, someone like you, it might seem odd. How was the experience for you?
Well, Swami never stressed the cultural principles of a USA. He never said, oh, in England, they have these principles and values and we need to nurture them. He expressed the Sanatana Dharma, the five eternal human values, love being the primary, Dharma, Shanti, Prema, Ahimsa, or doing the right thing, peace, nonviolence, truth. These five eternal values for all humanity are expressed at this particular time by the avatar through Indian culture. When the avatar comes, the country into which he comes, that was predestined. That was predetermined. And all souls in that country at the same time have come together with the same purpose. The foundation of Swami's, of God's mission on this planet is through an Indian culture. He must support the best values of that culture. And Swami has often said, I must take care of my own room, my own house, before I can clean up the world. I must take care of my own house first. Most of this incarnation, Swami has focused on Indian culture, values, and through that, lit the world's fire of values throughout the world. Now, what will happen next? Think about this. As Premasai, it will not be the cultural values of India itself that are talked about so much. It will be the eternal values of oneness in the entire world. The entire humanity, family of God and man.
In fact, if you look at Indian culture, as you also mentioned, what Swami refers to in Indian culture, I think for want of a word it is used Indian, but what it actually refers to is that ancient spiritual heritage.
That's true.
Of the world, actually.
Right. The Sanatana Dharma. And when we come to the Vedas, for instance. Yeah. Now, people say the Vedas are Hindu. No, they're not. Actually, the Vedas were cognized 20,000 or more years ago by the greatest rishis. Saying rishis meaning liberated beings who could directly feel and tune into the eternal truths of humanity, the blueprints of creation for humanity and the evolution of the world and all beings in it. These are the Vedas. At that time, the language was Sanskrit. Now, Hebrew came from Sanskrit. If you notice, Hebrew has a lot of the same similar words. Hebrew is about 5,800 or 6,000 years old. Sanskrit's 20,000 years old. Abraham was a Brahmin. He came from a family that was Hindu, or they were about to form Hinduism. There was idol worships that he felt the priests of the time were taking advantage of the people. So he said, I don't want to have anything to do with idols because the priests are taking advantage of the people. You have to go through the priests to worship the idols. I don't want to have any intermediaries between me and God. He established Judaism, the formless oneness of love for the unmanifest reality. He was Abraham, a Brahmin. That was the family he came from. From that language of Sanskrit came Hebrew at that time, just about that same time. So the languages that were born from one primary language fundamentally. As a traditional language, it was Sanskrit and the rudimentary forms of Sanskrit back then. the Vedas were cognized directly by those that knew Sanskrit. They weren't saying, I am Hindu, I am writing this down like the Bible. This is not the same. The Vedas are the original blueprints of the creation of all beings and humanity, and the blueprints of the how to live correctly according to the Sanatana Dharma.
Yes. So, once you understand that these Vedas are the reference to Indian culture, it is actually not referring to a particular thing attached to a religion. It is referring to something which is eternal.
Yes.
If you go by eternal. That spirit, then I think everything becomes easier to understand and accept.
Yes, this is true. It's expression of the eternal values of life.
Then, you know, all these differences between the practices of different religions, they don't matter.
Exactly.
Because ultimately, at the core, the spirit of every religion is the same.
Exactly. And Swami has said, it is good to be born into a religion, to be born into religious values.
Yes.
It is good. But it is not good to die in a religion. Why?
We have
be
to transcend that, because
yes.
All religions ultimately are different boats.
That's right. I see all religions as ways of talking to God. They're different languages.
Correct.
To talk to God in and express God.
And if someone says that Swami was so much for the practices of a particular religion, I would say that to associate Swami with religion is something where we have gone completely wrong, because what Swami has always been stressing is that which is beyond religion, which is spirituality, which is at the core of religion.
Actually. Absolutely right. Religions are ways, ritualistic ways, of containing and helping people become spiritual. Once we are aware that God is inside ourselves, in our heart, and we are starting to feel the relationship we have with God in our heart, and we start to feel the oneness, the religion gets shed like a skin that has grown too tight to be lived in any longer.
Yes, yes. So, once we have come to that understanding, then we should shed it, as you mentioned. Then you grow into that consciousness of freedom.
Absolutely right. And then in that consciousness of freedom, you can embrace all religions.
You can embrace all religions. You can embrace all the practices.
All ways
of
expressing.
You look at the spirit behind all the practices.
Yes.
And then there is no conflict at all.
Absolutely right. Okay. So now when I come to India and I sing a Telugu bhajan, I feel the love I have for God in Telugu. I just learned Telugu in those bhajans. It's important to know the meaning, so I find out the meaning. And if I sing it in Sanskrit, I sing my love for God for Sanskrit. If I sing it in Hebrew, in Hebrew. If I sing it in English, I have my love for God in English. So many languages.
That is what Swami says is love. Expansion is love. In fact, I'm tempted to read out again what Swami has given in that conference that was held in Rome in October 1983. Swami says, a person without religious tolerance is like a counterfeit coin or a flower without fragrance. It is not enough merely to adhere strictly to the practices of one's own religion. One should also try to see the essential unity of all religions. Only then will man be able to experience the oneness of divinity.
This is beautiful. So Swami, in my particular life, took me from being an atheist to being Jewish. I was the first Jewish person ever to light the menorah with God and then touch his feet, which is never done. Mm. But how can you not? And so then after that, about 8 years later, 9 years later, the grace of Swami was that I led Christmas here. Wow. In Prashanti. Now, here's a Jewish person leading Christmas songs to Jesus. And I loved it. I mean, I just expanded into the love I had for Jesus and for all Christians, and our way of expressing love for God that way. And it was wonderful. I mean, Swami was very, very happy.
Yeah.
Very happy.
I think that is a transformation that has happened with all of us. We celebrate a Hindu festival like say Krishna Janmashtami or Shivratri with the same zeal as we celebrate, be it Buddha Purnima or Christmas. You know, I sometimes tell my mom, you know, the number of festivals that we celebrate have increased by 4 or 5 times, because everything that Swami celebrates, we celebrate. Then you have your own festivals that has come down from your forefathers, a certain ritual that you do in the family, and etc., etc. So that's how Swami has expanded our consciousness. And, you know, then there is no one who is unwelcome.
This is beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife is Italian, so she's Italian Catholic. Her last name before marriage was Italiano. You can't get more Italian than that. And so we have children. We have a son who's 17 almost, and I have a daughter who's 12. My son's name is Satya Paul Levy. And my mother said, "You missed Muslim." Oh, I should have called him Satya Paul Allah Levy. That would have really been integrated and, universal. Yeah. So it is kind of like Swami, and Swami told me to marry and pick my wife for me. Mm. And by the grace of Swami, it was a wonderful moment, and we spent a year here living together at Swami's feet.
Yeah.
And he has made me from such a narrow-minded person, when I was so narrow-minded when I was young, to someone who is accepting of all forms of worship in all ways, at all times, in the spontaneous combustion of love for God.
Great. So it has been really wonderful speaking to you. I just hope that this understanding and this awareness of why we are doing what we are doing, and, you know, how to see what we are seeing, be it in Prashanthi Nilayam or be it anywhere else, develops in all of us. Because then we can really move on to that phase where, you know, our heart expands to everything that we see. And then you can feel and experience that oneness of divinity. You just go out of this narrow restrictions of a particular practice or a particular religion or a particular belief system. And then just how everyone comes to Swami, you know, everyone feels that love for Swami, even you start experiencing that. And then I think that is the dawn of golden age for me, for every person, for you, for every particular individual. And perhaps when that happens, then automatically the world will be a different place.
Wonderful. And Swami has said, be the change that you would like to see in the world.
Yes.
Be that change.
Yes. Wonderful. Thank you very much for your time. And I hope we will have more conversations in the future on this particular theme, because understanding Swami's teachings is super important. Only then can we really practice them in our lives. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, and thank you too, Bishu.
Sarah.
You just heard a conversation with Dr. Alan Levy, a practicing modern psychoanalyst from Westport, Connecticut, USA. In conversation with him was Radio Sai's Bishop Prishti. This was recorded in the studios of Radio Sai in the month of November 2011. We hope you enjoyed this program. If you have any comments or suggestions about this program, please feel free to let us know by writing to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and Sai Ram.